Thank you. helps to motivate people to get decisions, because when one acts, one person needs to think of another, just motivating to attend other lectures. That's one thing that I'd like to hear from you. I can't go in depth with you. It's a very big, great honor for me to be a science speaker. I've worked with Governor Dr. Breitwitz at an event that's sponsored by the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. Dr. Breitwitz graduated from the Johns Hopkins University with honors with a Bachelor of Science degree. And he graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School and a rabbi. But more than being a rabbi, he's probably one of the rabbis who's probably most demand to give lectures. And probably he would be given every synagogue and every organization that would ask him to lecture. He's probably not had any time for his wife and kids and no synagogue. So I certainly want to thank you personally, rather than having to accept the honor of staying here tonight. But one of the interesting things is that I visited my sister. She's in Bethesda, Maryland. I spent the time in her synagogue a few weeks ago, Thanksgiving weekend. I was seeing some people there, and I mentioned that I never had a job writer. Who was in Bethesda, Maryland. So in Bethesda, Maryland, my sister synagogue, I met some people there, and we're having him come up to speak to us. And I said, hey, how did you get that on? So I was trying to look at a rabbi's rabbi in our entire community. When our rabbi has a problem, everything gets diverged about my community. So with that, I want to have the great honor of introducing Rabbi Dr. Susan Don Frazier.
Thank you, Elliot, for that very kind introduction, and I very much appreciate all of you coming out on a cold night to hear a talk, which frankly probably does not have as exciting a title as kosher sex and some of the other things, but I hope at least that the content should, if not be equally interesting, at least something that can help us as we approach the holiday that is coming up in the Jewish calendar. What is Hanukkah? You know, the American Jewish community has had a little bit of a trouble defining exactly what Hanukkah is. There was a time in which, because of the so-called December dilemma, because there's some other big holidays of other religions that are occurring during this time, that Hanukkah was supposed to be the Jewish counterpart to Christmas. That is why some of the fancy gift-giving was done, etc. Some people even have a Hanukkah bush, which I think is not as common today, thank God, at least in some levels. Things have improved. But then there's a counter-reaction. Now you hear a lot of Jews saying, which is true, but I think misguided on some level, Hanukkah is not that important. Hanukkah does not correspond in its importance to the Christian holiday of Christmas, which is true. But what that tries to say, in effect, is to denigrate Hanukkah, to take away its importance, which is not right either. Hanukkah is very important. And Hanukkah is not just a commemoration of something that is historical, but Hanukkah has particular relevance for the conflicts and dilemmas that Jews face who live in affluent societies, such as we are fortunate to do in the Western countries, in the United States, and the like. You know, the phenomenon of galut, of exile, can take many, many different forms in Jewish history. For much of our history, and in many places in the world, even today, the galut is one of persecution, one in which Jews might be killed, Jews might not be allowed to practice their religion. And one problem of galut is, how does a Jew keep his Jewish identity when his life is threatened, when his security is threatened, when he's not allowed to practice his religion or whatever, or is denied civil and political rights? That's one aspect of Jewish identity. In the United States, by and large, we don't face those particular problems. We live in a society of freedom. We live in a society of political and social equality. We almost had, had they counted the votes in Florida, not only a Jewish vice president, but indeed a very proudly observant Jewish vice president. And one can gather that Senator Lieberman's aspirations for higher office are likely to, once again, find an expression somewhere down the road. So, what's the problem? Well, basically, we have to understand that the issue of Jewish continuity and the problem of Jewish religious affiliation is even greater when there's affluence and prosperity than when there is adversity. The Lubavitcher Rebbe once remarked that it was easier to be Jewish in Siberia than in suburbia. And that is, in Siberia, or Nazi Germany, or whatever it is, if you wanted to deny your Judaism, there was always somebody there to remind you in very strong terms. And thus we have the unusual phenomenon of a young woman who converted to Catholicism and became a Carmelite nun and died in Auschwitz. And now the Catholic Church is trying to canonize her as a martyr to Catholicism, when it was obvious that what Hitler was saying is, you're a Jew and you can't escape it, whether you want to or not. So paradoxically, we find that throughout Jewish history, Jewish religious expression has often flourished when there was external persecution, simply because you couldn't escape being a Jew. So, if you can't escape it, you live with it, and you run with it. Precisely in a free society. You know, we use the phrase Jew by choice for people who convert to Judaism. We often talk about Jews by birth versus Jews by choice. But that is a false dichotomy. Because every single person in the United States who decides to affiliate as a Jew and who decides to practice Judaism is a Jew by choice, because nobody's forcing you. And therefore, ironically, we have to communicate to ourselves and to our children reasons to be Jewish, which perhaps were not necessary for most of our history. In Poland, you didn't have to give a child a reason to be Jewish. That's just what you were. In America, you have to give those reasons. Historically, the two reasons that commonly were given as motivators for Jewish identity have been the Holocaust and the State of Israel. We've often used the Holocaust in a legitimate way, really, to show the enormity of Jewish suffering, the barbarism of trying to erase the Jewish nation from the earth. And we remind our children that this has to be a never again. We have to be committed to Jewish survival and Jewish continuity. The Holocaust has been a great galvanizing focal point for Jewish identity. But if we want to be really, and of course where I live in the Washington area, we have the National Holocaust Museum, which by the way actually has more non-Jewish visitors in the course of the year than Jewish visitors, but that's okay because there's nothing wrong with the non-Jewish world understanding that chapter of the history of the 20th century. But if truth be told, the Holocaust no longer carries, and this is unfortunate, but it's true, no longer carries that same type of weight. You know, after a while, when you pitch Judaism as be a Jew because we have a history of being persecuted, be a Jew because we've been victimized, be a Jew because we've been kicked around, after a while, people might begin to say, well, why do I have to identify myself as the person that stepped on? Why do I have to identify myself as the persecuted? Let me get away from that. So the truth is, you're going to find, and again, it's very unfortunate, but you are going to find that in some circles, our Jewish youth are actually impatient with Holocaust. They say, we're talking about it too much. This is, again, I'm not expressing my opinion. I'm just saying what I hear out there. We're talking about it too much. Let's move on. Let's kind of forget that past a little bit. The point is, you can't define Jewish identity by what you are against. You can't define Jewish identity by saying we got to be Jewish to fight the anti-Semites. You can't define yourself by your enemy. You must define yourself by positive affirmation. Let's go to the second basis of traditional Jewish identity, and that has been the State of Israel. There is no question that the State of Israel has been and still is a source of enormous pride to our people. Draining the swamps, making the Negev bloom, being a place, a safe haven for Jews from all over the world. And yet one has to admit that the State of Israel itself is facing not just the crisis in terms of physical security, but it is facing a very, very serious philosophical crisis. Those of you who are interested, perhaps you have read the book by Yoram Hazoni, which describes in graphic detail the Jewish state. The philosophy that is called post-Zionism, in which many of the most prominent intellectuals in Israel do not believe in the idea of a Jewish state. They say Israel should be a state of its citizens. They want to change the Hatikva. They want to have side by side in the Jewish star the Muslim Crescent have a joint flag because it is racist and exclusionary to have a Jewish state. And these are not, a few crackpots making these positions. These are people who are very well respected in academia and even in the government, although they perhaps do not always express their views in that extreme way. The point is that 50, 55 years of war and turmoil have sapped energy. Many people do not see many decisions of the Israeli government as totally moral. The point is, by way of introduction, the traditional ways of establishing Jewish identification. Number one, the Holocaust, or in a more general sense, fighting anti-Semitism. And number two, the State of Israel, do not have the power that they once had. And we are now faced with the dilemma. How do you remain Jewish in suburbia? In Siberia, you had that way. You were forced. What do you do in affluent societies? What do we give our children? What connection do we give them? In truth, all of this is very much connected with the story of Hanukkah. The story of Hanukkah in broad outline is undoubtedly familiar to most of you. It was at a time when the land of Israel, Palestine, as it was called, was under the domination of the Syrian Greek Empire out of Syria. A breakaway, this was the after Alexander the Great, his empire had split into two parts. And during the reign of one of the successor kings, Antiochus promulgated a number of decrees prohibiting the practice of religious expression, and a very small group of Jews organized under the Hashmonaim, Matisyahu and his children, led a civil rebellion which overthrew the Greek persecutors and established an independent Jewish monarchy. Now, Hanukkah too, what does this represent exactly? Then we have the story of the oil. A little bit of oil was found, and that oil was only enough to burn for one day, and miraculously it burned for 8 days, and Hanukkah, as it were, became an eight-day festival. But what is it that we're really celebrating? Many say Hanukkah is a celebration of the First Amendment of the Constitution, as it were. The First Amendment of the Constitution is freedom of religion. Hanukkah celebrates the freedom to serve God the way you want. But there's another aspect of Hanukkah that we often forget, and that is the war that the Hashmonaim were waging was not just a physical war against an external threat. Rather, many, many Jews had become what we call Hellenists. Many, many Jews had abandoned the Torah, had abandoned the mitzvot, were willing to assimilate, to intermarry, and not, as it were, even not even circumcise their children. The real enemy in a lot of this struggle was not merely the external tormentor, but it was the apathy and the ignorance and the assimilation of the Jewish populations themselves. Because Antiochus was willing to be quite benign. Antiochus was not a Hitler. Antiochus was perfectly willing to let Jews live and prosper as long as they abandoned their heritage, as long as they gave up what was unique and distinct about their religious identities. And therefore, indeed, the story of Hanukkah is not merely the idea of freedom from persecution, but the story of Hanukkah is the need to take concrete and affirmative action to combat ignorance, to combat assimilation, to take the steps necessary to give people a positive reason to be Jewish, and not merely a negative reason because we have to be Jewish because of our enemies. Hanukkah is indeed the festival from which we learn how Jews in affluent, permissive cultures continue to stand up for what is authentically Jewish and maintain that heritage and pass it down to our children. In this sense, I'd like to go back a little bit with a story we read in last week's Torah reading. And that is the story that the night before Jacob, is going to meet with his brother Esau that he had not seen for many years. And he gets this, and he hears the message that Esav has 400 soldiers, and Esav is going to kill him, because Esav is still mad over that blessing that Yaakov had taken so many years before, more than 20 years before. And Yaakov is really scared, and Yaakov prepares himself for his encounter with Esav. And according to the rabbis of the Talmud, and you see this in biblical verses, Yaakov did three steps He took three distinct steps to prepare for his encounter with Esav. Number one, he sent gifts in order to propitiate, to flatter, to butter up Esav. Number two, he prepared for war in case that became necessary. And number three, he turned to God in prayer. It seems from the Talmudic commentaries about this that the encounter that Yaakov has with Esav is said to be a prototype of how we relate to external cultures generally. And that is, when we confront a world, much of which is antagonistic to the values of Judaism, there are three different approaches that we have to embody all at the same time. Number one, for some things we send gifts. In other words, there are aspects of the culture out there that we welcome, that we embrace. There is much in the world that is ennobling and uplifting and spiritually beautiful. And that we don't reject things by closing ourselves off in an artificial ghetto. We embrace that which is proper. But there are other things which we must wage unrelenting war against. And by war, I don't mean physical battle, and I don't mean throwing stones, and I don't mean any type of physical activity at all. But I mean that perhaps the greatest danger that we face as Jews is the adoption of ethical relativism, ethical subjectivity. I'm okay, you're okay. In which anything that one advocates is fine because there are no moral absolutes in the world. Judaism, and again I'm not pushing particular interpretations at this point, but a religion is not a religion unless it states a certain degree of moral and ethical absolutes. A religion that basically says, I can do what I want, is essentially self-worship. You know, Voltaire once remarked that the Bible says that God made man in the image of God, but far too often, man makes God in the image of man. And far too often, we find ourselves reconstructing religion to simply allow what we want to allow. So, Yaakov's dichotomy is, some things you must embrace from the outside world, some things you must reject. And through prayer and spiritual guidance, you will have an understanding and a sense of what to accept and what to reject. Meaning, we live on a tightrope. In a way, it's much easier if you adopt a stance of rejectionism, in which you say everything out there is treif. Or conversely, if you live with ethical subjectivity, everything out there is fine, I'm okay, you're okay. The dilemma of the Jew, and certainly those of us who are parents know this very acutely, is how do you know where to draw the line? Certainly, I think all of us agree, whatever our religious observances on the spectrum, that there is out there, if I take something like the internet, things like pornography, filth, immorality, and as responsible parents, we have to draw certain lines and certain boundaries and certain structures. And yet, we can't separate ourselves from the world totally. This is what Yaakov is saying. Some things you welcome, some things you expel, and pray to God that you'll be able to figure out what on earth those things are going to be. That's really one point in which we see from Yaakov at least the dilemma of how we respond to the problems of modern life. But I want to go to the next scene. The night before the big encounter, Yaakov's family has already crossed over the Yabok River, and Yaakov is there all by himself, picking up some last minute property that he forgot to take. And he wrestles with a man all night. And in the morning, the man wants to leave, but the man can't get away. And Yaakov says, give me a blessing. And the mysterious man says, your name shall no longer be called Yaakov, which is the heel. It shall be called Yisrael, he who triumphs with God. But then he smites Yaakov on the leg. And Yaakov is limping the next morning. And because of this, the Torah says, Jews do not eat the sciatic nerve, the Gid HaNasheh, because that is where Yaakov was hobbled, and that's where Yaakov was injured. Who is this mysterious man? Why is Yaakov wrestling him? Yaakov asks this man, tell me your name. And the man's response is, don't ask my name. I'm not telling you. What's going on? And the Gemara tells us that this mysterious man was an angel, and this angel somehow was the guardian angel of Esav. That somehow, the night before he meets the Esav in body, he struggles with the Esav in spirit. But I'd like to share with you a wonderful thought that the Hasidic masters tell us. That the Esav, which is always symbolic of evil and the like, the Esav is not the Esav, his brother, that's outside of him. The Esav is the Esav that is within him. He is wrestling with his own demons. Meaning, before he's ready to confront the evil out there, Yaakov, in the loneliness of the night, no one else is around, has to engage in the private struggle. Am I worthy of God's blessings? Have I perhaps engaged in immoral means to secure the ends which are proper? Yaakov is wrestling with his own demons. And it is precisely the integrity and the honesty of his struggle that allows his name to be changed to Yisrael, he who will triumph. Because a person that does not have the honesty to wrestle with his own demons, to examine his own motives, to look into his own character, to determine where can I improve, where can I grow, what do I need to do within myself? Only such a person can ultimately develop a relationship with God. We live in a world in which we are so swift to demonize others. We live in a world, as it were, where if the Messiah has not come yet, we say it's somebody else's fault, whatever that somebody else might be. And yet we see from Yaakov's struggle that before one confronts the Esav from outside, one must have the honesty and integrity to confront the Esav within. And that's a lonely struggle. The Torah emphasizes, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, Yaakov is by himself. It's the night. He doesn't have the support of family and friends. You gotta go through that struggle. You have to have integrity. You have to have authenticity. And then you're given the blessing of he who will triumph with God, which is the name Yisrael. But then let's go on one final scene in this, and I'll connect this all to Hanukkah. And that is, he asks the angel his name, and the angel says, why are you asking my name? So most of us learn that the angel isn't giving him an answer. But there's a commentary that says the angel is giving him his name. My name is, why are you asking my name? My name is, why are you asking? What does that mean? A mashal is given, the following humorous story, about a farmer who was coming from a little village in Poland. He had never seen, he had never been to the big town, and he had come to the big city on a market day, and he was told that if he buys a ticket and goes into that movie theater, he didn't know what a movie was, he would see animals and people coming out of the wall. And it would be the most amazing thing, that these things would just materialize out of thin air. So the guy didn't believe it, but he bought a movie ticket. He's sitting in this dark room. And all of a sudden, exactly what they told him happens. It was a spaghetti western, very popular in Poland, between the wars. And cows and horses and cowboys and Indians are all coming out of the wall. And he thinks they're real. And he can't believe it. Where did they come from? There was a wall. So he pulls out the new flashlight that he just brought. And he shines it on the wall to get a better view of what was coming out of the wall. And lo and behold, the picture disappeared. And the people told him, sit down or shut off your lights. The picture is only visible when it's dark. Rabbi Lloyd Chassman, one of the great rabbinic teachers of the past, of the 20th century, made the point that this is a metaphor for life. We go through life and we think so many things are important in life, whether it be the money we make, whether it be the material assets we accumulate, whether it be the petty grudges that we bear. You know, there are people who don't talk to each other for decades over reasons they can't even remember why. But it's so important to be right and not to concede. And we go through our lives, and sometimes we're alienated from our parents, from our children, from our spouses, from our former friends, because we think so many things are important. But if we would just turn on the lights, think about what life is about, all of those things that seem to be so real when the lights are off vanish and become meaningless when the lights are on. In other words, this thing is a mashal that certain things look like they are significant, but that's because you have not turned on the lights. If you turn on the lights, you see what is important. And some want to say, to continue it by Yaakov, this is exactly what the angel is saying. When Yaakov is asking the angel, what is your name? It could be understood as, what is your power over people? If this angel on some level is a concretization of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, if this angel somehow represents that which takes us away from living a good moral life, Yaakov asks, what's your power over people? That's your name. And the angel responds, because nobody ever asks, nobody ever thinks about it, nobody ever bothers to turn on the lights. And therefore, I snare them and I trap them into a destructive pattern of resentment and hatred and alienation, because they never bother to have the perspective of where their lives are going and what their lives are for. And it's been well said that no person ever said on their last few minutes on earth, I'm sorry I didn't spend more time at the office. That is not going to be the thought. Why didn't I do one more deal? A person will think about their children, about their spouse. A person will think many, many things, perhaps, if they're fortunate enough to be conscious. But they won't think about that. But when you don't turn on the lights, you see all sorts of things as important, which may not be important. And thus, inferentially, if you think about Hanukkah, just in the very generic sense, the concept of lights dispelling darkness. Part of what's going on when the light dispels the darkness is we become like the person who realizes when he turns on the lights what's real and what's not real. And that's why there is no accident that the word Hanukkah means dedication. And historically, it was connected to the rededication of the temple. But it's also a dedication for us. We rededicate ourselves as Jews during this festival of Hanukkah. And in fact, the word for education is chinuch. Chinuch and Hanukkah are really the same word. Dedication, education, consecration. All of those ideas are connected. Which is why, by the way, there was a custom in Eastern Europe. I don't know if it's followed here. And it's not imitating the non-Jewish custom, that those people who teach Torah to children get some extra Hanukkah gilt around Hanukkah time. Because that is actually true. The custom of giving the kids is later. But the custom of giving the teachers is actually a... And again, I don't teach here, so I have no conflict of interest in saying this. But there is a concept indeed that Hanukkah is the time of dedication, particularly in the area of education. Again, which is why I'm especially appreciative that in this last lecture of the series, which is about Hanukkah, you have all chosen to participate. So, I just want to suggest, and I will get back to Hanukkah more specifically, but I just want to suggest, when we think about chinuch, rededication, education, consecration, turning on the lights to see what is real, as opposed to turning off the lights and seeing things that aren't really important, there are a number of points that I think we should consider. And that is, number one, what are our priorities in life? What are our true priorities in life? You know, they tell the story about a gentleman who is an obsessive compulsive person. And after his retirement, he was going to be taking his first trip to Israel. But he was told there would be a 7-hour stopover in Paris. Since he was obsessive compulsive, he spent the year before his trip learning French, so that he would be fully prepared to order a Coca-Cola in the Charles de Gaulle airport. And, when you're older, it's harder to learn a language. But he put in the time and effort, and lo and behold, the great destination, the great day of the departure came, and he was able to order a Coca-Cola in perfect Parisian French. And he was very happy with himself for 7 hours. And then it was time to board the plane. and he realized with a sickening feeling in the pit of his stomach that he never bothered to learn Hebrew because he was so preoccupied with the stopover that he never thought about the ultimate destination. I certainly don't want to be morbid or macabre, but the truth of the matter is we don't live forever. There is an ultimate destination, meaning all of us, at the end of our lives, give an accounting of the goodness that we've done, of the morality that we've created, of the love that we've shared, of the mitzvot that we've done. And while we're on this earth, hopefully for 120 years, there are many stopover skills that we have to master, you know, to drive, to work, to do other things. But one who only concentrates on the stopover and doesn't prepare for the ultimate destination is as short-sighted as that individual who learned French and never bothered to learn Hebrew. So one very important sense is that we communicate to ourselves and to our children that what is ultimately important in life is not how much money you make and not how much power you have. Those might be nice things. Indeed, Judaism is not in favor of renunciation and poverty, per se. But the point is we have to teach our children what is truly important in life, a sense of priority. I think it's also very important, you know, there's an old saying in Yiddish, it's schwer zu sein a Yid. It's hard to be a Jew. Well, indeed that may be so, but the truth of the matter is, if that is what we are communicating to our kids, even if we try to identify as Jews, but if we communicate the message, it's rough, it's hard, it's burdensome, it's a schlep, then obviously that's not a message that carries any particular continuity, because after a while people begin to wonder, gee, why do I have to suffer? We have to try to inculcate a sense of joy, of enthusiasm, of renewal, of excitement. It's very, very difficult, and indeed, again, I'm not familiar with the communities, but indeed one of the major challenges that synagogues have in particular is how to regenerate a sense of spirituality, of excitement, and of passion. Far too often, even the most observant people in a community may do things out of rote, may do mitzvot mechanically, may do things a certain way because we've always done them that particular way, without a passion, without an excitement. And the truth of the matter is, it's not going to communicate itself to others unless we can have that type of excitement, that type of joy, that type of vibrancy, which is so essential for true religious expression. I should also say, too, that another quality that we need to inculcate is the sense of courage. Courage is a quality that's often misunderstood in the modern world. Courage is defined as bungee jumping, or courage is defined as, former President Bush jumping out, doing a parachute. Bush indeed had, I think, had genuine courage in his life. Certainly, I'm not taking that away. But the idea of jumping out of a plane and opening the parachute is courage. But that's not the courage that I'm talking about. Pirkei Avot says, in Ethics of the Fathers, Eizehu Gibor, who is a strong person, who is a mighty person, who is a heroic person, Hakovesh et Yitzreel, he who can subdue his passions and his inclinations. The idea of self-control, the idea of self-mastery, the idea of not giving in to peer pressure, not compromising on one's morality, because everybody else is doing it. The courage to be enough of a nonconformist that you have the strength and the fortitude to do the right ethical and moral and Jewish thing, even if people around you think you're a fool. And that takes a lot of courage. Now again, each of us has different environments. Certainly, this would be the courage in some places of not, you know, taking drugs and engaging in illicit sexual relations. For others, it would be the keeping the dietary laws. Everyone has their particular trial and temptation. But courage means you don't simply go along with the trend, but you have the strength to do what is right, even if no one else is doing it. And in fact, it's interesting. There's a halakha that expresses this idea. And that is, there's a halakha that says, if an animal falls off a roof, let's say the animal is still alive, you're not allowed to slaughter it and eat it for meat, because there is a fear that its skeleton has become so dislocated that it's no longer a kosher animal. But the halakha says the way you test whether that's true, this is before x-rays and veterinary MRIs, is you put the animal in the water and see if it swims. If the animal can swim, its skeletal structure is considered to be intact. Now, I think about this. This reminds me of the Salem witch trials a little bit. In the Salem witch trials, one of the tests, whether a woman was a witch or not, was they would tie a rock to her leg and they would throw her into the water. If she sunk and drowned, she was innocent. If she was floating, she was guilty and would be burned at the stake. So it's really a no-win proposition. You have a similar dilemma for the animal. If the animal sinks, you know, it's strike, you can't check it. If the animal can swim, you can slaughter it and eat it. So it's similar to the Salem witch trial. But then the Gemara makes the following interesting comments: that swimming is a proof of skeletal health only if it is bucking the currents, but not if it's swimming with the currents, because even a dead creature can be carried with the currents. Again, if we allow a little homiletical license, what that statement is saying is, going with the flow is not a sign of spiritual life. You can be dead and go with the flow. The ability to overcome the flow is a sign of spiritual life. So we mentioned the sense of priority, the sense of joy and enthusiasm, courage. And I just want to mention one other quality and then segue back to Hanukkah. And that is a quality that perhaps is a very, very difficult challenge that we face. And that is how to combine a sense of commitments with a sense of tolerance, acceptance, and generosity of spirit towards others who may not have those same commitments. You know, we have two types of Jews that seem to be functioning in the world. We have Jews, that Eric Hoffer would use the term true believers, who are passionate and fiery in the rectitude of their convictions. But the result of such zealousness might sometimes be a sense of disparagement and rejection of those who are not quite at the same place. And then we have another type of Jew, which is, I'm okay, you're okay, the Big Ten type of Jew. I love all Jews, we're all good, we're all brothers and sisters. But that shades into ethical relativism, moral subjectivity, situational ethics. I stand for everything because I stand for nothing. Once again, the tightrope, and perhaps one of the central goals of Jewish education, has to be how to create a passion and a commitment to Jewish values, which at the same time is grounded in love and acceptance and respect, not just for Jews, but for all human beings of all races and creeds. And that's difficult because the human personality tends to veer to one extreme or the other. You tend to either be a zealous, principled person, or you tend to be kind of a waffling accommodationist. And yet, how do you engender moderate passion? Or how do you have passionate moderation? Is there such a possibility? Well, one could look to Avraham Avinu. Avraham, Abraham, our patriarch. Abraham, on one hand, is the person that is called Ivri, the Hebrew. And according to rabbinic literature, the phrase Ivri comes from the other side of the river. Originally, the Jewish people came from east of the Euphrates. But according to the Midrash, the idea was he had the courage of his convictions. He could be on one side of the river and the whole world could think he's crazy. And he stood steadfast in his belief. And yet, that same Avraham Avinu prayed and cajoled and bargained with God to save even the degenerates of Sodom and Amorah. That his love for all, even those who on one level he may have felt were not worthy, but they were in the image of God. They had godliness in them. And he prayed for them. So these are things that we think about: priority, joy, courage, commitment, together with tolerance. And how do you achieve both? And these are all ideas connected to Hanukkah. Because if Hanukkah is the time in which we turn on the light and we dispel the darkness, and Hanukkah is etymologically related to chinuch, education, and Hanukkah teaches us how do we deal with assimilationist pressures, then these are all the types of lessons that we need to concentrate about. I want to say one other thing that the Chafetz Chaim points out. Why do we only find an angel struggling with Jacob and not with Avraham and Yitzchak? We don't find any angel attacking Avraham and Yitzchak, only Jacob. Chafetz Chaim, the great sage of the who died in 1933, says the following idea. According to the Midrash, each of our patriarchs had a unique way of serving God. Abraham's way of serving God was by loving kindness. Yitzchak's way of serving God was by prayer and sacrifice. And Yaakov's way of serving God was by the study of Torah. The Chafetz Chaim says that the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, as it were, is perfectly willing to let Jews do loving kindness and even willing to let them pray. But the one thing the Yetzer Hara will not let Jews do is study Torah, because Torah guarantees continuity. Everything else can last a little bit, but it's not going to perpetuate itself. And therefore, I hope that all of you realize the tremendous importance of your participation in a program like this. Coming to study Torah is the absolute most important way that Jewish continuity will be engendered. More so than prayer services, as important as they are, more so than even acts of loving kindness, as central to Judaism as that is, you have to have that element of Limud HaTorah. The other point the Chafetz Chaim makes is, why did the angel hit him in the thigh? So he quotes the Zohar, the book of Jewish mysticism, that says, just as the thigh supports the body, so too the Achilles heel of Judaism will always be that those who support the Torah, the economic support of Torah, will always be weak and limping. And the Chafetz Chaim says, this is the curse of the Jewish people, that Jewish education will never be adequately financed. And I've even heard it said, and maybe it's a self-defensive statement, that any Jewish educational endeavor that does not have financial difficulties cannot be authentic. Because it was the curse of that angel that the support of the Torah, the thigh, would always be hobbling and limping. Right? And Chafetz Chaim says that's exactly why, to this very day, Jewish education is so sorely underfunded. Now, of course, that doesn't mean, you know, if someone asks you to contribute, you shouldn't say, well, I'm sorry, this is the curse. You know, it's similar, you know, it's similar to Eve, right? Eve was cursed that you shall give birth in pain. And yet, at least the Jewish position is, we do allow anesthesia during childbirth. Meaning, this is the way naturally is, but you can certainly try to overcome it in whatever way you can. Okay. Just a few extra concluding remarks about the symbolism of Hanukkah. And that is, there's a very interesting argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How do you celebrate Hanukkah? It's amazing. All of us know. What do you mean? Everyone knows how you celebrate Hanukkah. The first night you light one candle. The second night you light two candles. Until the eighth night you light eight candles. Simple. Well, not so simple. Nothing is ever that simple. Beit Shammai says, you go in reverse. Beit Shammai says the first night of Hanukkah you light eight candles. And you go down till you hit seven, till you hit one. Right? Now, of course, as is commonly the case, when there is a dispute between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, we follow the house of Hillel, which is why we have never seen any backward menorahs yet, right? The only menorahs we make, or we see, are 1 to 8. But Beit Shammai says you go from 8 to 1. What logic would there be to this type of machloket? Like, why should you go from 8 to 1, 1 to 8? And I want to share with you a thought, a beautiful thought from one of the great Hasidic masters, the Sfat Emet, that says the following. Fire and light has a dual imagery in our tradition. It symbolizes both the light of God's presence that illuminates the world and brings goodness and holiness. But the fire is also a human soul. You know, on a yahrzeit, the anniversary of someone's death, we light a candle, a yahrzeit candle. And that is based on a verse in Mishlei, a verse in Proverbs. Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. The soul of a person is a candle that is lit by God. In fact, one of the words for soul is nefesh. Nefesh, and here I hope you could follow me, is an abbreviation. The nun is ner, a candle, a receptacle. A pei is besila, a wick. And a shin is shemen, oil. What are we? We are the receptacle, the wick, and the oil, waiting to be ignited by God's light. We are a ner. We make ourselves a candle to receive God's light. So when we look at the Hanukkah candles, we're looking at a mirror of ourselves. That fire represents the human soul, the beauty of the human soul ignited with the goodness of God. Well, therefore, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are both viewing the candles as a mirror of the human soul, but they look at fire in two different ways. Fire is that which burns away and destroys, and fire is that which gives warmth and illumination. Beit Shammai says, when I look at my soul and I want to perfect myself, I want to improve myself, how do I do it? So Beit Shammai is a tougher person. Beit Shammai says, identify your faults and surgically blast them away one by one by one by one. Now, look at yourself, identify the problems, and attack them. Frontal attack. Therefore, according to Beit Shammai, the self-improvement plan of Hanukkah would be descending, because how do you measure your progress? On the first day I had 8 things I had to correct. I burn it away, I only have 7, etc., etc., etc. Because the trajectory of spiritual improvement, focusing on one's flaws and one's inadequacies, you burn them away one by one by one by one, it goes down. Beit Hillel is more of a realist. Beit Shammai is perhaps describing the strong person who can look at their failures and simply eradicate them. Like Nancy Reagan said, just say no. Beit Hillel says, for many of us, looking at our mistakes, looking at our failures, looking at our weaknesses, may actually be very destructive. Because we become so mired in depression and hopelessness and despair that we lose the strength to do anything about it. And therefore, Beit Hillel says, the way one builds a connection to God is not by focusing on their mistakes, but rather building on their areas of strength. Generating, in other words, not burning away the bad, so to speak, but generating light and warmth. And by focusing on what we are good at, focusing on the mitzvot to which we feel a natural connection, we build reservoirs of spiritual strength and stamina that will eventually allow us to vanquish and overcome the negatives in our lives as well. Meaning to say, the way you fight darkness is not by taking a broom and attacking the darkness. You fight darkness by generating lights. And therefore, the trajectory is not 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, where you're burning away the negative, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where you're accentuating the positive, and the negatives get taken care of by dealing with the positive. And therefore, this is really a metaphor, although, you know, we associate tshuva, repentance, with the high holiday season. But the truth of the matter is, the lights of the Hanukkah can also teach us some lessons in character development. Let me leave you with one final question. And this is the most famous question in the annals of halachic literature about Hanukkah. Very obvious question. Many of you may have heard this, but it is an obvious question. So if you haven't thought about it, you should have thought of it, because it's a very good question. And that is, what's going on here? The Jews found enough oil to last for one day. They put it in the menorah, and it miraculously burns for 8 days. Therefore, we have Hanukkah for 8 days. But wait a second. There was enough oil for one day, so the miracle of Hanukkah is not burning for 8 days. Hanukkah ought to be 7 days. What's the miracle? The miracle is that which was one day burned for 8. So, 7 more days. So, the most famous question in halakhic literature is, why is Hanukkah 8 days? It ought to be 7 days. There are literally at least 500 answers to this question. This I know because I saw a book that had 500 answers to this question, and there might be more, but at least I saw 500 answers. I read every one of them. I just want to share with you a few answers because I think they are relevant to our appreciation of Hanukkah. One answer is actually relatively simple, that the first day of Hanukkah is not the miracle of the extra burning, but it's the dedication of the temple. In other words, we got the temple back. That itself is worthy of celebration. Another answer that is given is, well, maybe the concept is, you know, that you don't just celebrate the supernatural in life, but rather, from the supernatural events, you begin to appreciate everyday life as well. Meaning, don't just celebrate the miraculous that God gives you, but recognize that everyday life, the first day, is also something that's good. Now we say in our prayers, we thank God for the miracles that surround us every day. You know, in halachic Judaism, in Orthodox Judaism, there's actually a blessing that is recited after one goes to the bathroom. And you know, when kids are taught this, they often kind of laugh. They think it's kind of silly. Oh, I have to go to the bathroom. But I came across an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, very striking. Yeah, I actually have it. I happen to have it in front of me, in which he wrote a letter about the fact that he's a urologist. And, you know, he understands firsthand by his own medical experience why you have to be grateful when you go to the bathroom. You know, we laugh, but how profound this is. The normal operations of life, to be able to see and to hear and to walk, these are also miracles. So one of the lessons of Hanukkah is, we don't just make a holiday for the extra 7 days, but we recognize that the normal and the ordinary is also part of something to be grateful for as well. That's that first day of Hanukkah. But there's another explanation, a final explanation that I heard from the chief rabbi of Israel. And he prefaced his explanation with the following story. I don't know if you know the story of Rabbi Lau. Rabbi Lau was in a concentration camp as a young child of three to four years old. And obviously the Nazis would have killed him had he been discovered. His brother concealed him in a sack, a burlap sack, which he would carry around with him during the day somehow. And, I mean, I just can't even imagine exactly how that worked for over a year. But basically, he said, to him, the miracle was that nobody ever looked into the bag. If they would have looked into the bag, he would have been in big trouble. So he says the following. Let's go back. You live in a world of darkness. Darkness has many forms. There is darkness of ignorance, of apathy, of assimilation. You know the old joke about what is the difference between ignorance and apathy? And the person answered, I don't know and I don't care. Which is actually a right, totally accurate answer. There is a lot of darkness. There's that darkness of ignorance and apathy and assimilation. There's the darkness of illness. There's the darkness of despair and depression and loneliness. We live in a world of darkness. And sometimes we feel that the little candle that we can light is not going to make any big difference. Look at it in that miracle. They're not going to have good oil for 8 days, whatever the reason is. This oil only lasts for 1 day. They might as well say, what's the point? What's the use of my lighting this little bit of oil? Why is it going to make a difference? It's not going to make a difference. So why bother? And the truth of the matter is, that's a metaphor for the way we often look at the world. Why bother? Why bother to make this gesture and that gesture? It's not going to make a difference. What Hanukkah teaches you is, when you're confronting darkness, you light the candle that you're able to light. And then God takes it from there. And God turns it into something that goes well beyond what you thought it could have done. But had they not bothered to light the candle, there wouldn't have been that miracle. So I think Hanukkah is a tremendously important message about the fact that we have to light whatever light we can bring into the world, even if we think it's insignificant, even if we think it's not going to make a difference, even if we think it's not going to change anything. The miracle of Hanukkah says we do what we can and God blesses our efforts beyond what we thought would be possible. So again, I wish you all a season of dedication and a happy Hanukkah. Thank you.